International, socialistworld.net, Committee for Works International. Maybe there'll be an article up about the Mexican elections very soon, hopefully. People in Mexico are voting today. It's an extremely important election, and it looks like a progressive slash perhaps left winger still, López Obrador, will be elected, and his party Moreno or Morena, sorry if I mispronounced, I don't have any articles in front of me on that. They will be campaigning for seats in the Mexican legislature. So hopefully they'll do well, but as we said earlier, there's going to be problems right from the start because of the nature of capitalism internationally and even within Mexico. It's going to be put up or shut up time very quick. So here we are, top of the hour. Let's read a public service announcement, maybe even a couple of them, because that's our duty here as DJs at WMFO. This is numbers to think about, worldwide prison populations. This is a prison population rate world map from Wikimedia Commons based on UN data. Prison population per 100,000 people. The United States, end up quoting here, the United States has the world's largest documented prison population, both in absolute and proportional terms. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, more than 2.2 million prisoners are behind bars in the United States, a rate of 730 per 100,000 people. China, which is four times more populous than the United States, is a distant second, with 1.51 million people in prison, a rate of 117 per 100,000, while Russia has the second highest rate, 606 per 100,000, for a total of 865,000 prisoners. Now, these are numbers to think about, basically that the U.S. has the highest aggregate and proportionate number of people in prison more than any other country, which is really, really horrible. I mean, how do you go around saying it's a free country with so many people in prison? Numbers to think about, a message in the public interest from WMFO and Medford Tufts Educational Radio. And now I'm not like a, what do you call it, the old-fashioned word, teetotaler, but I'm looking for something better. I'm not that person. I'm not calling for a prohibition or anything. But I noticed in the public service announcement book here, numbers to think about alcohol consumption, American alcohol consumption. Now, I don't, never had a no drinking policy in my life, but most of my life, actually I did when I was up until my 20s, I think it was, or 18 or something, but even then I didn't like jump into it in a big way and would go through long periods of not drinking, and I don't need to drink at all and don't really like most drinks. If you threw a sangria in front of me, I would drink it immediately, but just like the fruit nature of that. The deal is that for me is I just usually for many, like even a decades long, not drinking alcohol. Now, why is that? Well, it's expensive. I don't have any money. It doesn't taste that good to me. And, growing up, a lot of people around me drank and smoked. And, some people, there's that old cliche, nice drunk or mean drunk. I found that it kind of did break down that way in real life. And I was around one too many mean drunks, like their body's response to alcohol was to get belligerent. Like, their inhibitions would go down. I guess their main inhibition was, I'm not going to kill everybody. I'm not going to be really, really angry all the time. And the alcohol took that away and they got really, really angry and started to try to hurt people. So that was the mean drunks out there. I did see some drunks that got all like funny sort of and whatever, so-called nice drunks, but just too many mean ones out there. So anyway, I get uncomfortable. I go to a place and people start getting drunk, at a party or at a bar or something. And you can just see the threat level rising. I'm a big one for, personal safety and safety of others. And I just, see stuff happening. So that's a long-winded way of introducing this. So numbers, think about American alcohol consumption. 30% of American adults don't drink at all. That's pretty much me. Another 30% consume on average less than one drink per week. On the other hand, and this is the point of this whole thing, it's trying to get a clear picture of alcohol consumption in the U.S. On the other hand, the top 10%, and only 10% of American adults, 24 million, that's a lot of people, but it's only 10% of the population, consume an average of 74 drinks per week, or a little more than 10 drinks per day. Oh my God. a little more than 10 drinks per day for me is just plain old alcoholism. So there you go. Again, just 10% of the adult population drinks more than 3/4 of all the alcohol consumed in the United States. That's kind of shocking. While 30% of American adults don't drink at all, another 3% average less than one drink per week. Like I mentioned, the top 10% of American adults, 24 million, consume an average of 74 drinks per week, more than 10 drinks a day. It's just repeating what I already mentioned, what I mentioned above. In any case, these are some numbers to think about. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. All right. Yes, so we're going to take a quick musical break. Throwing on some music I didn't even listen to, so if it's garbage, I apologize. If it's good, that's great. And we'll be back soon. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio at WMFO.org.
And stars, we meet at the border with its beauty and its scars. The sunken city rises in this land of drought. The border is restless in this land of doubt. Stars and crosses, crosses and stars, we meet at the border with its beauty and its scar. In the shadow of the cradle by the altar we say, our Father who art, our Father we pray. Say it, stars and crosses, crosses and stars. It's beautiful. Stars and crosses, crosses and stars. We meet at the border with its beauty and its scar. Sun turns iron to rust, gold to ash, falcon to dust. Stars, crosses, crosses and stars. It's beautiful. Stars, crosses, crosses and stars. Thank you.
I'm alive and well and working. Still whole, ain't gonna break. I'm poor, proud, surviving, dreaming, fevered America. Pastor John, I'm clawing, bare bones but free. Bob blocks from me, soul till I could talk.
That was Red Black Red with Dream in Fevered American from their album called Resettlement. And before that, there was Sam Baker with his song Land of Doubt from his album Land of Doubt. And never heard these songs before, never heard these albums before. Just thought I'd, based on their titles, take a chance. And glad I did. They were okay. Okay is not very, not probably not good enough a word, but they were good. They were worth playing, and I hope we play them again. Now we're going to move on to the Janus decision, which is short for an attack by capitalism through and through its Supreme Court, controlled by the this whole thing about judicial independence, judicial impartiality, is a complete and total 110% joke. And the Supreme Court is there to make sure that if the people in the United States get too democratic, if they actually elect their own leaders, which they can't do through the Democrats or Republicans, but say they did it through another party, or they get through some sort of referendum or some sort of mass movement, regardless of the electoral duopoly that the capitalists have through the Republicans and the Democrats, the Supreme Court is there to stop, put a break on things. That's illegal. That's and it's mimicked on the state level as well. So I mentioned earlier a referendum in Massachusetts. There's some referendums in Massachusetts that got kind of mushed together and weakened by the Democratic Party legislature here and the Republican governor. Other situations, other states, including in Massachusetts, actually, the Supreme Court will weigh in. There was supposed to be a millionaire's tax. A tax on anyone. I have to had to re-familiarize myself with the exact details, was a tax on like about 2% of the state's population making over $1 million or something like that, and it would have raised a lot of money that was going to be earmarked for for education. The Supreme Court just said that was somehow illegal. And I don't even want to get into the so-called reasons, because there weren't any. It was just a power play. So that is not even going to be fought for now, because the coalition of unions and others that kind of were pushing that, they are very much, into sort of not going, not pushing the envelope. They're very much into sort of the Democratic Party and keeping things all nice and within the legality of the moment, which is a huge, huge mistake. So there aren't going to be occupations. There aren't going to be massive retaliation in the streets for taking the millionaire's tax off the ballot. It's just off the ballot quietly and on to the next liberal project, although that would have been a great thing. We would have supported that and campaigned for it and been out there fighting for it too. But sometimes, if the unions and other groups are going to claim to be so powerful, then they have to show it, and they don't show it. They subsume everything to the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party is in turn subsumed to capitalism and controlled by capitalism. So there you have the conundrum that we keep coming back to, the problem we keep coming back to in American politics. And the real sad part is that some so-called socialists get confused by this and latch onto any progressivism they can find and elevate it to an obsession that can't be criticized. And that often includes supporting Democrats, so-called progressive, or even so-called left-wing Democrats. This is a huge mistake and won't gain us anything except strengthening the Democratic Party in the short and medium term. Part of what we're paying for with the lesser evil strategy of, Democrats are slightly better than Republicans in some ways, and worse in others, I would say, in a sense of they can get away with more than Republicans. Republicans are just straight up horrible, obviously, but the Democrats can introduce regressive legislation and so on, like Clinton administration did, or the Obama administration did, the big bailout under Obama, the big corporations. They can get away with that because, in the vague recesses of some layers of society, Democrats are somehow more progressive than Republicans, and therefore they can't really be helping the corporations out so much to the detriment of workers. I mean, millions of workers being evicted from their homes didn't get any help, but the big corporations that were losing profits during the Great Recession got bailed out under the Obama administration. So that is don't think too hard about that. Your American head might explode, because that's how we're trained. We're trained to think in binary duopoly terms when it comes to electoral politics, and we can't apparently hold more than two thoughts in our head at a time. We can't apparently understand that a Democrat in the service of capitalism will pretend to not be in the service of capitalism and tack in a left populist direction, because that will gain votes and will help neutralize a growing opposition movement, meaning opposition to certain issues or to certain policies or to capitalism itself. And we just can't seem to grasp that if somebody gets up and says, hey, I believe in X, Y, and Z, but does so within the parameters of a pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist political party like the Democrats, then, well, that's okay. That's progressive somehow. But it's not. It's a step backward. But back to the Janus thing, just read a quick, this is from CNN, just because it's a quick summary. So last Wednesday, on June 27th, Supreme Court ruling came down that was mainly aimed at public sector unions, meaning unions that work for city, state, or federal governments. So the ruling said, I'm quoting here, simply that public sector unions can no longer require non-union workers to pay fees that allow unions to collectively bargain. The practical effects of this decision are that unions will lose considerable bargaining power, and that union membership could well sink. Well, it's already sinking, or last year actually went up 262,000 members. Not enough, but it went up. That's a vicious cycle that union allies insisted was aimed at reducing the political power of unions as well, which for decades were one of the pillars of the Democratic Party's success. Meaning that, and you'll read this a lot when you read stuff about Janus from the corporate media, that unions would find ways to support Democratic Party politicians through donations, and then that became illegal. And they did in-kind donations, like they would have their members go out and knock door to door, or they would have use resources that phone banking or using office space and stuff like that or set up other organizations that they could then use to support the Democrats. Now, of course, Republicans are much more direct. People that support Republicans, I'm sorry, not the Republicans themselves necessarily, but them and the people that support them, the rich people, are much more direct in their, bundling checks and so on and doing all sorts of things to get around whatever small laws there are against. A lot of them have been struck down against direct donations to political parties by the super rich and the super rich corporations. Who also donates to the Democratic Party, by the way, Democratic Party candidates. So they reference this happened in Wisconsin and back in 2008, 2009, 2007, I forget the exact date, Wisconsin struggle, where the governor there, Scott Walker, for years tried and eventually succeeded in reducing collective bargaining rights for public employees. It went beyond the not being able to collect dues from those that aren't technically part of the union, but that the union must represent. Anyway, let me explain this in my own words, because it's simpler than this article. I thought the article was going to be clear. So you're in a union, and it used to be, historically, you could organize a union where everyone had to be in the union in a certain workplace as a condition of employment. And that was called a union shop. There was even a stronger thing called a closed shop, where the company had to only hire from the union. So that would guarantee you a union workforce as well. That was outlawed as part of the Taft-Hartley Act, which was a horrible anti-union legislation from 1948. Now, some labor leaders you talk to will say, oh, Taft-Hartley was good. We like it. Well, they liked it because it creates laws, including some that seem to be helping the union. But what it really does is the preponderance of laws in Taft-Hartley are taking away the power of unions. So one of the biggest powers unions used to have that's now technically illegal is what used to be known as sympathy strikes. I think if you call them solidarity strikes, you'll get the picture. A union goes on strike and you decide that to help the labor movement as a whole, to help working people as a whole, we're going to support that other union by going on strike ourselves. So we're going to notify the company and the government and whoever, the press, that, hey, we're going on strike in support of this other union that's on strike here. And because we believe in their cause and we're doing solidarity, it's completely illegal now. And a lot of labor leaders will say, we can't do that because it's illegal. Now, some labor leaders that are a little tougher, a little smarter, will do something like refuse to cross picket lines. So while they're not going on strike themselves, which is a huge pressure on the capitalists collectively in a given area, if a lot of places go on strike, there's huge pressure on the original striking company, the original company that was struck, to settle with the union. Absent that enormous pressure, there's a lesser pressure but still an important one of not crossing picket lines, obviously, out of solidarity. And you can still do that, but a lot of unions have forgotten that. And they do cross picket lines. Other things in Taft-Hartley, there's just so many that create a situation where employers can exploit the law, even ones that seem to be pro-union. And also, for example, in Taft-Hartley, there's a thing about you can't replace workers on strike permanently. So during a strike, you could hire scabs. That's okay for the government. But you can't keep them on forever afterwards. Starting really with the Reagan administration, riffing off of Carter's deregulations and so on, the Carter administration's deregulations and so on, the Reagan administration, NLRB, and subsequent National Labor Relations boards have just ignored that law. The law's on the books. They just ignore it. So a company can, if there's a strike, they can try. They don't always try to do this, but they can try and sometimes succeed in firing all the workers that went on strike or laying them off or whatever, and continuing to operate with scab labor, with non-union labor. And that's technically illegal, but if you don't enforce the law, it's not really illegal. But the laws that hurt the unions, they're enforced. So you have these things set up by Taft-Hartley that are now being changed or attacked or ignored, and it was rotten to begin with. And the public sector unions are under attack. They claim here that in Milwaukee, for example, which is within Wisconsin, where this happened a decade ago or something similar to Janus, union membership has dropped 30%. What also happens is when a union is subject to these right-to-work laws, like this Janus thing is now nationwide. It used to be just certain states on public sector workers. The right-wing anti-union forces in the country that are funded by the big corporations, they go to the areas, now it's going to be nationwide, and they try to convince people to drop out of the union, to stop paying their dues, because they don't, they can get away with not paying a fee. And this is the whole point here, that prior to this ruling, if you were in a union, it's not a, closed shops were made illegal by Taft-Hartley. Union shops are hard to negotiate. They should be negotiated, but they're difficult. So you end up with a third category, which most union workplaces are now, I believe, or at least the most new ones, where you have people in the union that choose to be, and then you can have people choose not to be in the union. And but if they're not in the union, they still have to pay a fee that is close to the amount of union dues. So most people, like where I work at Harvard University, this is the rotten situation we have set up, where you have union dues payers, and also people can opt out of paying dues, but they have to pay a fee. And this is a private sector union, so that's not going to change in the short term. So they have to pay a fee, and most workers then say, well, if I'm paying a fee, I might as well just pay the dues, because they're very similar in amount. And if I pay the dues, I'll get to vote on contracts and ostensibly vote on representation within the union, although that gets tricky. Some unions are more democratic than others. But, you know, you definitely get some voting rights, and you help the union paying dues and so on. So it's obviously better to always pay union dues from a standpoint of a socialist and a union activist like myself. But I'm talking about the way people think about it. What this does is it lets them get out of paying dues or paying a fee, but still being represented by the union, because that's one of the things that Taft-Hartley put in, that you have to represent everybody in a workplace or in a bargaining unit as defined by the National Labor Relations Board. It might not be everybody in a workplace, but most people. You have to represent everyone, and according to Janus now, the Janus ruling, you have to represent everyone regardless of whether they pay anything into the union at all. So obviously it's a way to bankrupt unions if non-union workers that don't pay a fee use the union resources up, then the union doesn't get that money back. And also the article talks about the fact that unions used resources to help political candidates. They'll have less money coming in now, less resources to help political candidates. Now, I wasn't too thrilled. I am not too thrilled. In fact, it's a horrible thing that unions support the Democratic or Republican parties. This is absurd. It's lesser evilism. It's not helped the labor movement. It's supporting your class enemy's political party, basically, you know, the corporate Democrats or the corporate Republican parties, corporate Democratic Party or the corporate Republican Party. But, like the article says, unions are tied in to the Democrats in terms of hoping for favors in return for a lot of support in getting elections, getting you know, winning elections. And this is going to make unions less viable politically, less powerful politically, because they'll have less money to use to organize with. And I don't, that's a bad thing, because I think at any moment unions could switch away from the Democrats and start building their own party, and they would need money for that. Also, they have, some unions have supported independent candidates before, left-wing, progressive, independent candidates. So that's harder to do with less money. And that's, so this is a really horrible right-wing, or, you know, liberal, depending on the real nature of liberalism, pro-capitalism, decision. Now, how unions respond to it, we've talked about on the show before. They could have been organizing mass protest movements, linking with other movements to, like, the 15 minimum wage movements, Black Lives Matter, the, you know, women's movements that are happening around the country, and the immigrant rights movements. You know, there's a lot of combustible material under the Trump regime, a lot of organizations that, if they didn't stick to single issue but saw the issues as interrelated as they are, led by or partially led by the labor movement with a lot of resources and, you know, part of the class struggle, whether they like it or not, this could really turn into a big movement, maybe even the beginnings of, again, a workers' party, you know? Instead, what the unions have been doing, unfortunately, is saying we have to set up mechanisms within the union to still collect dues from as many people as we can after this Janus thing goes through, which it did last Wednesday. Now, that's okay. That's something you have to do. But a lot of that dues collection is going to come from how people feel about the union. And if you're winning, if you're getting victories, if you're not doing concessionary bargaining, but you're doing bargaining that gains people wage increases and benefit increases, so on, then they're more likely to sign up for the union. If you're on the defensive all the time and you're just appealing to people with the lowest common denominator, well, at least we give you a grievance procedure. At least we, you know, will help you if you're in trouble. If you do the insurance company policy type unionism, we're just an insurance company, call us when there's trouble and we'll come down and maybe you'll fit the policy, your problem will fit the policy, that sort of thing. No. It's got to be a social, union has to be a social movement. It has to have an internal democratic life to it. It has to have a history of struggle, or build a history of struggle, or build struggles. It has to win. It can't just lose all the time. And through that, you can create, I would argue, you could create 100% dues collection. And there was a time when unions did not have any sort of law mandating how they would get dues. And that's where, like, for example, shop stewards, if you're familiar with union terminology, a union representative within a larger union representing a geographic area, usually, or a number of workers or department or something. Shop stewards used to be the ones that would have to collect dues. You know, they had to go around, politically motivate, explain why you should be in the union. Now, not everybody is that articulate. It might just be, you should be in the union because the rest of us are in the union and it helps us, which is a fine argument. No problems there. But that argument is not even used a lot of the time when the dues collection is automatic through the Taft-Hartley Act originally, and through various things since then, where your dues come automatically out of your paycheck. And the unions like that, right? It saves them a lot of hassle, but it also takes away that political motivation. So I'm not saying that the Janus thing is good at all. It's a horrible decision. And I would take automatic dues collection. You know, fine, that's fine. There's other ways to motivate people than asking for dues. But all I'm saying is that this does not have to result in unions declining significantly. It can actually strengthen unions if unions learn again, if union leaderships learn again how to fight, how to have a vision of a socialist future, and seeing the union as part of that. and then having the energy and the political motivation to go out and argue for every last penny of dues and argue for every last gain in benefits and wages instead of doing concessionary bargaining. And then if all these things come together, being a solidaristic union, being a social union, being a union that is tapped into the community, community struggles against racism and so on, then the unions will flourish. And maybe we're going to see a revival of the American labor movement based on the big teacher strikes and what we've described before on this show of how these happened in some of the most conservative, quote-unquote, areas in the country. The teachers were able to go out on strike and win enormous gains. So we'll talk more about Janus in the future. We'll keep ourselves and our listeners and so on updated about how this is being fought or not being fought. There also were some demonstrations against Janus this week. Needs to be a lot more. That's good. Needs to be a lot more, though. There needs to be, like, you know, let's occupy, let's get enough people in the Capitol in Washington, occupy the Supreme Court chambers, whatever it takes, you know. Let's get people out on the street in every city that has a AFL-CIO, labor federation grouping in the cities, central labor councils, they're usually called. Let's do, again, tie into the other struggles that are happening right now for social justice, because that's what unions are, basically social justice organizations, but in a strategic location, the workplace under capitalism. You stop work, you stop the system. You stop work, you stop a part of the system and hurt the capitalists where it hits them. You hurt them where they live. Sorry. Profit making in their money. By the way, just a real quick memorial, let's say. June 27th, 1954, Jacobo Arbenz Guzman is deposed in Guatemala. He was a Democrat elected president. And the CIA, speaking of interference in elections, the CIA of the United States sponsored a coup to protect the profits of one big company based in the U.S., the United Fruit Company. Arbenz was replaced by decades of brutal U.S.-backed regimes who committed widespread torture and genocide. And you wonder why people flee countries in Central America, including Guatemala, because the United States screwed things up there. Things were not perfect or anything, but they were made worse by imperialism and by the United States. There's a, that's all we'll say now, except for, if you want to read more about this, there's various books, one by Stephen Kinzer called Bitter Fruit. There's also Harvest of Empire by Juan Gonzalez. And I got this from this sort of thing I get on email from the Zinn Education Project, meaning Howard Zinn. But getting to what we promised earlier, now we have very little time for it, is a quick look at the economy for working people under this so-called boom. And there's a book that's getting some treatment, some mention, in some corporate media. I heard them on National Propaganda Radio, a short thing where an author named, let's see, let's get the name right here, Alyssa Quart, Q-U-A-R-T, has written a book called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And she, Alyssa Quart, is also affiliated to Barbara Ehrenreich and a thing that they started, or Barbara Ehrenreich started, called the, I used to have this title, I was just researching it the other day, I think it's called the, Economic Hardship Project, something like that, and I wish they had mentioned it in this article, and they didn't. So Google Quart, her name is Q-U-A-R-T, first name Alyssa, A-L-I-S-S-A, also the title of the book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, and it'll probably take you, some in piece of information will probably take you to the Economic Hardship Project, or whatever the proper title is, and check out some of the articles on there. Now it's interesting because, you know, I haven't read the book yet, but I like what I'm hearing about it, and I like the approach, and, but, you know, I find it a bit arbitrary. I mean, she's taken big issues, and the interviews take big issues to examine in terms of the so-called boom, but with low inflation, that is actually people that are hurting economically, financially, and there's incredible inflation happening in aspects of their lives that they can't afford. So Alyssa Quart looked at, through Squeeze, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, she looked at, education, healthcare, housing, and childcare. And these are all incredibly important, you know, survival things that you have to look at in the society at this time. But immediately I thought of, well, what about other things that working people are getting hit hard by now? The increased cost of gas and heating oil this winter. It's going to be horrible. What about, most likely, what about increased taxes? You know, you want to know how communities get gentrified. Well, a lot of them are, you just raise the property taxes up a certain amount and people can't afford the taxes anymore. And they lose their homes. You want to talk about elder care and just in child care. You know, you hear these ads on the radio, speak to the law offices of Greedy, Scumbag, and Greedy, and we will set up a trust fund. They're not even that clear. That's what they're doing, but they don't even tell you that. They say, we'll help you afford the high cost of nursing homes where, you know, $14,000 or $15,000 a month could quickly bankrupt you. Of course it could quickly bankrupt you. Somewhere along the line, and I haven't been able to do the research due diligence yet, but somewhere along the line, elder care, senior care was incredibly deregulated. I have a feeling it was in the Carter administration, but maybe it was a little later in the 80s. So instead of seeing these municipal, which I've actually witnessed this right in the Boston area, it says, and where I grew up in Schenectady, instead of seeing New York, instead of seeing municipal run, city owned, state owned, I'm not sure states were too involved, but cities definitely were, elder care places, you know, senior homes, rest homes, they used to call them, and so on. Somewhere along the line, that stuff got privatized darn quick, and it's all for profit now, and the cost, and they're able to charge whatever they want, whatever the market will bear. Sometime in the future, if we have a social society, the market will bear, whatever the market will bear is going to be like an enshrined slogan in the hall of horrors of capitalism. It will be in a museum to the injustices, the daily injustices of capitalism, the mass murders, the mass genocides, the mass wars, etc. And then somewhere it's going to be how this ties in economically, and it's going to be what the market will bear and all the suffering that brought on people, all the death, needless death that brought on people. I mean, there are people, I can tell you, there are people killing themselves because they don't want to go into an expensive nursing home. They don't want that burden on their children. And they can't afford the high law fees, lawyer costs of negotiating some sort of agreement. But anyway, so my original point, though, is that somewhat arbitrarily, but I guess she had to focus, and those are good things to focus on, but also there are many other costs right now in American life that are going up horribly, that are really hurting people. So anyway, getting back to this article, which, by the way, I'm going to be maybe quoting from, so I better get the source here. It is Why the Middle Class Can't Afford American Life Anymore, Larry Gettlin, New York Post. Starts off with stories. People like to hear these individual stories about teachers that also have to be Uber drivers and stuff like that. But I want to get to some of the facts here. Quote, middle class life is now 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. Middle class life, and by the way, I'm going to start substituting the word working class instead of middle class. Middle class is a joke. So when you hear working class, know that in the original it was middle class. So working class life is now 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago, Quart writes. That's the author again of Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Citing the costs of housing, education, healthcare, and childcare in particular. In some cases, this is a direct quote, in some cases, the cost of daily life over the past 20 years has doubled. In one of her book's many striking findings, Quart writes that according to a Pew study, P-E-W study, quote, before the 2008 crash, only one quarter of Americans viewed themselves as lower class or lower middle class. no longer. After the recession of 2008, a full 40% of Americans viewed themselves as being at the bottom of the pyramid. Pyramid is a pretty good visual image to keep in mind about the American economy, but it's more like a pyramid with a thin space needle on top sort of thing. In other words, if you've seen the real graphics of wealth in America, there's a long, thin vertical line that just goes down from the stratosphere, because there's this tiny, tiny percentage of super, super rich parasites that in U.S. society, and they control enormous amounts of wealth, so far above what the vast majority, what like 99% of the people make, even other rich people. And of course, there's a hierarchy among the rich as well. So you have this thin line of super, super rich, rich, you know, going down, and then it starts to widen out. Then it winds, flattens out. It doesn't look like a pyramid, more like a wire leading into like the mouth of a vacuum cleaner or something. I don't know. It's just really, it's a very weird looking pyramid, but tiny points, long, long point at the top, and then a huge bottom of suffering. The main problem, quoting again from this book, is the lack of basic lack of 21st century safety net for families, Court tells the Post. Offering the cost of daycare is just one example. Now, in nearby Montreal, where daycare is government subsidized, daycare costs like $7 to $20 a day. That makes a huge difference for families. Figured annually for 50 weeks a year, 5 days a week, people in Montreal pay $1,750 to $5,000 per year on childcare. Let's look at the greatest country in the world, the United States. By comparison, Court says that here, many of the families I spoke to who were ostensibly working class were spending around 20 to 30% of their income on daycare. Now, I can personally testify to this and how the expenses of daycare basically drove my wife and I from having sort of a surplus when we first got married to being deep in debt. Daycare was a huge, huge part of that cost, debt. And we even got a little bit of help from a fund in our union, but that only paid for a fifth or less of what we owed, and the costs were just so huge. Annual averages in the U.S. on daycare spending range from $10,468 for a center-based childcare program to $28,905 for a nanny. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the average annual cost of infant care in New York State is $14,144. The average New York family with just one child pays 21.2% of their income on childcare. For two kids, that rises to 38.7%. Now, another thing I can add again, and we're really getting into this, is okay, so this is like child care for infants, and a very, very important statistic, 5 days a week. Well, what if the parents work more than that, which is common now? What if also they're not quite infants, but they, whether they're infants or not, not infants, but like, let's say toddlers or above, but they have to go to summer camp. That's even more expensive than daycare. Now, then they go back in this article to looking at teachers who get paid so little they have to deal with this stuff themselves. But let's again jump into some stats. Department of Education, college and university education. College and university administrative positions grew by 60% between 1993 and 2009, 10 times the rate of growth of tenured faculty positions at universities. And you have a situation now where 62% of adjunct professors earn less than $20,000 a year teaching. I try to live on $20,000 a year anywhere in the U.S. By contrast, in 1975, full-time tenure stream professors were 45.1% of America's professoriate. As of 2011, they are only 24.1%. Only one professor in six, at 16.7%, actually has tenure. Something like 40% of teachers in American colleges and universities are adjuncts, which is insane, she says. Middle-class parents are spending all their savings to pay for colleges where their children are going to be taught by people making $3,000 a class per semester. It's going to change the quality of education because people are teaching four classes a semester for no money. I would add on top of that, a lot of colleges use graduate students as teachers, but they really abuse that. I'm not objecting to that per se, but they really abuse it. And you know, you're paying huge, huge money, or trying to, some people, to get to go have these educations at these big universities, and then not even having what the bare minimum of what you expect, some professor up there, you know, yammering at your kid. So then there's more, stories about college teachers, how difficult it is. Now we get, she goes into the other professions that, you know, we were taught this is a path to success. Let's see. If a charity for professors strikes you as sad, because that's something they talk about, there's also a charity for members of another down-and-out profession, one that used to be synonymous with high status and massive salaries, lawyers. Leave Law Behind is an organization that helps lawyers exit the profession, declaring on its website, quote, there is an easier, less painful, less stressful, and lucrative way to make money, unquote. The organization's founder, a former lawyer named Casey Berman, told court that he saw his mission as motivating former lawyers who are neither... who are either broke or deeply frustrated or both. This talks about, for example, after the 2008 recession, law firms and corporations retained fewer lawyers, noting that lawyers in some states have it worse than others. And we'll get into that more. In Alaska, 56.7% of those with a law degree were not working as lawyers. In Tennessee, and different percentages, all over 50% for different states. According to the New York Times, 10 months after graduation, only 60% of the law school class of 2014 had found full-time jobs and long-time prospects. Let's see. But even if you do get a job, you might have to have a part-time job driving Uber or something, because a young lawyer who can get one of the few jobs remaining for, you know, tasks like reviewing legal documents and so on, a lot of that stuff... that used to be done by hand is being sort of some automated, algorithmed out. So you have some of these lawyers making just $17 to $20 an hour with $200,000 in student debt. As technology continues to advance, it will soon swallow the entry-level jobs that are left, even as college debt continues to increase. The average law student's debt was about $140,000 in 2012, a 59% increase over 2004. Then she gets into caregivers and how low they are paid, etc. Let me see. And then finally, the U.S. is the richest country in the world, but also the most unequal country in the world. It's the largest, has the largest wealth inequality gap of the 200 countries in the Credit Suisse Research Institute's Global Wealth Report of 2015. And when the top 1% has so much more than the top 5 to 10%, the middle class is financially, working class is financially and also mentally outclassed at each step. Now, again, a big problem here is that she, when it comes to solutions, social safety net, she talks about monthly allowance for families and individuals across the board. So that's guaranteed income type stuff, which is, you know, maybe a good thing. But here's the problem. That's too narrow of a solution. There's got to be a lot of other things. She doesn't mention the role of unions. Maybe in the book it's mentioned. She doesn't mention capitalism per se. She doesn't mention the S word, socialism. So I have a feeling this is more of a, you know, one of those kind of somewhat superficial sociological studies of problems that are right in our face. So anyway, we're starting to run out of time. Do I have time to get into this other one, this other article? Let us see. Maybe not. Okay, now we're going to go out with some music and assume that the other show is on their way. And we'll come back next week, in 2 weeks or whatever, with the more of the hard-hitting economic analysis that we started. Stuff like, you know, for example, there's all these stock buybacks happening, and you'd be surprised at the stats. Since between 2007 and 2016, companies in the S&P 500 spent 54% of their profits on stock buybacks. That's a lot of profits, 54% buying back their own stock. Then I had this article, UN showing extreme poverty. And this article I talked about earlier, I was going to get to. Let me just give you the headlines, and you can find it yourself. Check this out. And this is just, you know, again, sometimes stories are important to give the data some life, but you want to check out what's happening with healthcare in the United States. Quote, a baby was treated with a nap and a bottle of formula. His parents received an $18,000 bill. An ER patient can be charged thousands of dollars in, quote, trauma fees, if you've never heard of that, even if they weren't treated for trauma. And it's a whole article from Kaiser Health News, Jenny Gold, Kaiser Health News, and Sarah Cliff, June 28th, 2018. And Vox, I think, also did something on this. So they owed the hospital $18,836 for 3 hours and 22-minute visit, the bulk of which was for this mysterious fee, $15,666, notice 666 at the end there, labeled trauma activation, sometimes known as a trauma response fee. This coupled with, you know, outrageous emergency charges for whatever label they put on the fees, and ambulances now costing a ton of money to use. Yeah, Vox was the source also here. This is incredible. And they're doing a big investigation on this. And I'm not saying that you never heard of this gouging before in the healthcare profession, but it just goes to show the ridiculous cruelty of capitalism, you know? And I got a thing on Facebook with a doctor defending this. A doctor, someone claimed to be a doctor defending this. Here's somebody who was charged $22,550 in a trauma fee for his visit to Queen of Valley Medical Center in Napa, California after a motorcycle accident. So the ambulance medics called for a trauma team. So the total visit came to $26,998, the vast majority of which was the $22,550 trauma fee. But I've heard of these huge bills for just like a ambulance ride to the hospital, you know, or anywhere, you know. Let's see. Yeah, here we go. They do talk about it. There's a 30-year-old nurse, Alexa Sulveta, broke her ankle rock climbing in a San Francisco gym this past January. She faced an out-of-pocket cost, meaning the insurance won't cover, $31,250. An ambulance brought Sulveta to San Francisco General Hospital, where she recalled, "My foot was twisted sideways. I was given morphine in the ambulance." She was evaluated by an emergency medicine doctor and sent for emergency surgery. She was discharged the next day. The hospital charged her this big, they don't get into this $15,666 trauma fee. I thought they were going to get into the ambulance ride fees, which are huge now. Anyway, I'll find more data on that. I don't know why I'm obsessing about that. This is bad enough. Huge emergency room bills, huge trauma fees, and so on. So, little dose of economic reality there, and get ready for a recession, because usually when oil prices go up, it messes with the economy, because oil is a commodity that is invested in so many other processes and so many other commodities that like plastics come from oil and all that kind of stuff, heating, lubrication of all sorts, you know, and machines, running machines, you name it. So as oil goes up, it will exacerbate inflation. They try to blame inflation on wages, but empirically, you can prove that wages are trying to catch up to already rampant inflation when wages do go up, tailing inflation. They go up other times, but there's no correlation between when wages go up, all of a sudden inflation starts. Just no correlation at all. But you'll hear that in the corporate media coming up, because, it's going to get... It's going to get rough with the inequality being engineered and also exacerbated and made worse, you know, sped up is what I'm trying to get at, by the sort of shock and awe attacks of the Trump administration. I mean, the basic processes were already there, but the Trump administration is speeding them up and trying to do a lot all at once. So the single issue way of American politics with no Workers' Party can't really respond in a big way. That's a big problem. You've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. Thanks a lot for listening. I hope you found your way out to the protests about families being separated, but continue to protest. That's a horrible thing, but it's not the only problem, obviously, with immigration. We should be fighting for amnesty for our migrant brothers and sisters, and we should be fighting against capitalism to end the causes of mass migration out of fear and so on. And when someone says, well, they're here for economic reasons, yeah, no kidding. There's no violence greater than capitalism. So join the socialist movement. Go to socialistalternative.org, get in touch with us. Go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. Thanks again for listening. Thank you.